it's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's the latest episode of the WPR podcast, Mapped Out. We'll find out how a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's gerrymandered political boundaries went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. First, a U.S. House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has voted to hold Steve Bannon in criminal contempt. The unanimous vote came last night after the former Trump advisor declined to cooperate with the committee's congressional subpoena. It comes as former President Donald Trump is also fighting the committee's attempts to investigate the planning that led up to the attacks on the U.S. Capitol. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that and check in on negotiations over Democrats' social safety net proposal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Steve Bannon and others testify about what happened leading up to January 6th? Is it important for this congressional committee, you think, to get to the bottom of what happened that day and in the days leading up to it? What questions do you have about ongoing investigations into January 6th? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Mark Fisher is a senior editor at the Washington Post. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today. Do we have you here, Mark?
Yes.
There we are. We didn't have you turned up, I think. So before we get into that investigation, Mark, former Secretary of State Colin Powell died Tuesday from complications from COVID-19. Can you remind us of Powell's career and impact on Washington?
You know, he's kind of a throwback to a time when people across the ideological spectrum from both parties found enormous reason to respect someone who had a stellar military career that became a political career. As he moved up through the military, becoming a four-star general, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, National Security Advisor, and finally Secretary of State, he became a very popular figure across the country. He was the first African-American in all of those positions. And back in the mid-90s, not that long ago, there was pressure from both the Republicans and Democrats on Powell to run for president. And the curious thing about it, looking back from our highly polarized, divided nation of today, is that no one really knew what party he belonged to. And so at the news conference where he announced that he was not going to run for president, he also announced that he was, by the way, a Republican. And that was a news story back then, because you could be at a very high level of government in those days without being partisan aligned in the way that people are so consciously today.
Your Washington Post colleague Bob Woodward released interviews he'd done with Powell over the years. Here's a listen to Colin Powell sharing his cancer and Parkinson's diagnosis with Woodward.
Well, you see, I've got to go to the hospital about two or three times a week. I've got multiple myeloma cancer and I've got Parkinson's disease, but otherwise I'm fine.
Oh, no. I'm so sorry.
Don't say no, and don't feel sorry for me. For God's sake, I'm 85 years old. I've got to have something.
Well, you...
And I haven't lost a day of life fighting these two diseases. I'm in good shape.
What else did we hear from Powell in that series of interviews?
Well, one of the interesting revelations was that Powell and Woodward had spoken in about 50 interviews over the course of three decades of Powell's public life. And so you hear Powell's perspective shot through Woodward's books in a way that rarely happens to have that kind of insight onto the most powerful people in the government. I think Powell's legacy will really focus in part on what became known as the Powell Doctrine, which was Powell's notion coming out of the Vietnam experience. He was in Vietnam at the very beginning of that conflict in the early 1960s. And he came out of that whole experience believing that the United States could not and should not use force around the world unless it had overwhelming power and, very importantly, overwhelming public support. And he knew that the United States had suffered badly from the Vietnam experience because it never had that public support. He saw the same thing happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. He had real misgivings about going into Iraq, and yet he allowed himself to be put out there as kind of the public face of the attack on Iraq by the Bush administration, something he said in those interviews that he came to regret.
It's the week in Washington. We're talking to Mark Fisher from the Washington Post. Let's turn now to the January 6th committee. The select committee investigating the 6th voted to hold Steve Bannon in contempt last night. I want to give a listen to committee chairman Benny Thompson, a Democrat, before the vote on the contempt investigation.
Our goal is simple. We want Mr. Bannon to answer our questions. We want him to turn over whatever records he possesses that are relevant to the Select Committee's investigation. The issue in front of us today is our ability to do our job.
Now, Steve Bannon, speaking of Bob Woodward, in his book, he talks about Steve Bannon's role in convincing the president, then-President Trump, to come back in time for January 6th. Why the focus on Steve Bannon testifying before this committee?
Well, the Republican congresswoman from Wyoming, Liz Cheney, said that the committee has amassed evidence that shows that Bannon played an important role in organizing the January 6th demonstration and perhaps the attack on the Capitol as well. And she believes that if he were to testify, they'd be able to question him and perhaps get some information about exactly what he did to make that January 6th attack happen. So it's interesting that it's coming from both the Democrats and the Republicans on the committee, although most Republicans are not cooperating with that committee. But nonetheless, Bannon has written and spoken on his radio show the day before the attack on the Capitol, in which he urged people to come there and said it was going to be wild. And it sounds to the folks on this investigative committee like Bannon has some interesting information about the plotting behind that event.
So we've got this process started for contempt charges. Assuming it goes forward, Congress doesn't have people to go out and arrest people, really. A sergeant at arms, I don't think they do that anymore. Who enforces a congressional contempt charge?
Well, you know, like so many things in government, as we've learned in recent years, the idea that you have to testify before Congress when they tell you to is really based on trust. It's really based on doing as you're told. There's not really an enforcement mechanism. And what we're about to see with this contempt vote last night by the Select Committee, that will now go to the full House of Representatives in probably what will be close to a party-line vote. The Democrats and the smattering of Republicans will ratify the idea of holding Bannon in contempt, but that just triggers a long series of events. It then goes to the Justice Department, where they make an independent decision about whether they want to go after Bannon on contempt. Then it might go to a court. So this is a process that could drag on for months, if not years, by which time the Select Committee will have long since finished its investigation. That movie image of the sergeant-at-arms showing up at your house and arresting you and hauling you down to Congress to testify really is a Hollywood concept. It hasn't been done in decades. In fact, no one's been held in contempt for failing to appear before Congress since 1983. So this is really novel territory.
My understanding at the outset, Mark, was this January 6th commission was going to try to not go way into next year's off-year elections. So what does this mean? The fact that one of their key witnesses they want to talk to, the wheels of justice might move very, very slowly here.
It means that it seems highly unlikely that there will be testimony from Steve Bannon before this committee wraps up its investigation sometime in the next few months. They are not going after some of the other Trump aides for contempt. The former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, for example, he and others who are covered by former President Trump's refusal to allow his people to testify, they nonetheless are having their lawyers talk to the committee. They are cooperating to some degree. There are discussions about when they might be able to come forward in the next few weeks. So there is movement on most of these people. Bannon is the outlier.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ted is with us in Monaco. Ted, hi.
Hi. I would think it'd be very interesting to hear Bannon speak, but only after they've prosecuted all the people that burned down cities and murdered people and injured police officers every day of last summer in Kenosha, Oregon, Washington State, and all these things where it was like a blessing, like it was a beautiful thing to protest. And now here, this was probably the most peaceful protest that's ever happened in history. And the only person killed was a Trump supporter a woman who is a veteran who was shot by Capitol Police.
Thanks a lot for the call. We've heard a lot of people make the equivalency, Mark, between the George Floyd-related protests and the Capitol protests. There were, of course, thousands of arrests in the George Floyd riots and protests, lots of federal, state, and local prosecutions. Is this something we're hearing from conservatives at the national level, that equivalency that Ted is making there?
I haven't heard that comparison before, but it's a reasonable question to ask, and the caller should be very pleased to hear that any number of those cases stemming from the riots last summer have gone to court. A number, several more are in the process of coming to trial, so there's a tremendous amount of testimony about the violence that occurred last summer that is going on in courtrooms across the country, and juries are making their decisions. So that process is moving forward, just as this investigation into the January 6th attack is going forward. Yeah, it seems odd to call that a peaceful protest when you had not one person, but quite a few people. You had several police officers badly injured or dead as a result of that attack. So a tremendous amount of violence. And, you know, again, if you're looking for evidence, there are several excellent documentaries that have come out in recent days that really take you inside the Capitol, and you can see just the mob mentality and the extreme violence, the attacks not only on officers but on others who work in the Capitol.
We're talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at the Washington Post, with us today for our roundup of this week's top stories in Washington. Coming up, the latest on infrastructure and a social spending package in Congress, the ongoing saga. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What should stay? What should go in the, especially the bigger package before Congress? Negotiations keep going on. Climate change spending, extended child tax credits, and more. What is important to you? What do you want to see passed or blocked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Mark Fisher stays with us from The Washington Post. Now we're turning to infrastructure spending and social spending in Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's been going on a long time. Have you been following each twist and turn yourself, or do you want a wake-up call when something is done one way or the other? Is there a particular issue you hope gets dealt with in these spending packages? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mark, what are the latest important twists and or turns in the negotiations among Democrats over these spending bills?
Well, it is quite a soap opera, and if you like TV soap operas, if you miss an episode or two, you'll be just fine. And so what we're seeing is that this is really coming to a head this week. So despite all of the faux deadlines that we've heard in recent weeks and months, it looks like there may be a deal by the end of this week among the Democrats, between the progressive Democrats and the moderate Democrats. And that deal would move would shrink this massive economic bill from about $3.5 trillion down to perhaps $1.9 trillion. And what that means is that they'll be retaining most of the programs that had been proposed in the original bill, but they'll be shortening the time that they're in effect for, or in some cases shrinking them somewhat. The one sticking point that we've heard about in recent hours is that the progressives are pushing back against the idea of eliminating a program that would incentivize Americans to use clean energy. There still will be universal pre-kindergarten in the bill, which is a very important piece of the education package, but they may eliminate or limit the new benefit of 2 years of free community college for all Americans that was in the original bill. So right now, they're still talking. They're hoping to get things done in the next 48 hours. The key meeting took place last night between Bernie Sanders and Joe Manchin, the West Virginia California senator who's been the moderate kind of standing athwart this bill and saying it's too big, it does too many things. And they say that they're coming closer to a deal. The one person, however, who is also an obstacle to a final deal is the Arizona senator, Kirsten Sinema, who has remained kind of silent. There was a big lunch of Senate Democrats yesterday, and she didn't come to it. So it's not entirely clear how on board she is.
Let's bring on another caller now. Bob is with us in Park Falls. Bob, hi.
Yes, hi. My comment is I'm kind of a single-issue voter at this point on the climate change is the one thing I just hope doesn't get stripped out of this bill. And that now is our time to do it. Everything else, I mean, we can fight over infrastructure, all that, 2, 3, 4 years from now. I'm just afraid we wait on climate change, and it's just not going to be good. That's the one thing I just hope they can come together on.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Mark, you just mentioned at least some climate change-related funding in this bill. Looks like it may be on the way out, right?
Yeah, but there's still a lot of climate programs in there. So the progressives who share your caller's view about the primacy of climate change initiatives in this bill, they seem to be reasonably happy with the compromise that they're hammering out. So it's not everything they wanted, and some of these programs that had initially been thought of as permanent or 15- or 20-year programs might be sliced back to 10-year programs, at least the funding just for 10 years, but it does sound as if a lot of the people who are kind of climate first are reasonably satisfied.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. Is there a goal among Democrats here to get this done sooner, in part because the debt ceiling was just bumped back to December? Do they want to have this conversation separate from another debt ceiling extension?
Well, they have several incentives for getting it done right away. That's one. Certainly, you know, the clock is ticking as we head toward next year's midterm campaigns, which will make it more difficult to pass things. Then there are elections this year, just in the next couple of weeks. The Virginia governor's race is happening, and many Democrats believe that they're going to have a hard time winning that seat if Congress and the president don't come together and get this package through. The Democratic candidate in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe, has been very blunt about saying that the Democrats in Washington need to really get on the stick and get this thing through, or he's going to have trouble winning this election.
So Week in Washington, we're talking to Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post and expert on smooth transitions. Mark, because I wanted to ask you about that Virginia governor's race. You looked at the issue of abortion and how it's come up in this year's race for governor of Virginia, really one of the premier races in the U.S. in this odd numbered year. How are the two candidates talking about abortion now that a couple of key cases are added to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, one is and one isn't. The Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, who's the former governor of Virginia, is in these final days really pushing hard on the abortion issue, basically saying to suburban voters, and especially women, that this is a, you know, after all these years of saying the sky is falling about abortion, they're saying this is the real moment when there really is a threat, both because of the Texas law banning abortions there, and we're seeing a lot of T-shirts around Virginia of people say, don't Texas my Virginia, and then also because in this term, coming up in just a few weeks, the United States Supreme Court is going to take on a case that could well end with them overturning the Roe versus Wade protections of the constitutional right to abortion. So the Democrats are pushing this very hard. On the other side, the Republican candidate, Glenn Youngkin, is really not talking much about abortion. I went to a number of his speeches and rallies in recent days, and he, unlike most Republican candidates in the past, he's not talking much about his pro-life position. He does believe that abortion should be banned in most cases, but he's not talking about it because, as he was caught on video telling someone at a campaign event, he can't talk about it because he will lose the independent voters he needs to have a chance of winning. But he did tell that person in the same video that after the election, if he wins, then he'll go after abortion and try to live up to his pro-life position.
And did I see even a pro-life social separate group was downplaying the talk about abortion during this election for similar reasons, it sounds like?
Yeah, I was really kind of startled as I was reporting this story for the Washington Post about the role that abortion is playing in the governor's race. I called several of the groups that are anti-abortion in the state, and they usually have very strong positions about it and very strong feelings. And one of the leaders of one of these groups said to me, oh, it's just a side issue. Another one said, you know, we really don't have the support, so we're not going to be pushing for anything like the Texas law. It was really striking to hear that kind of pullback on the part of anti-abortion groups because they really want to win this election, and they realize that the large majority of Virginians are supportive of abortion rights to one extent or another, and so they've been persuaded somehow to pull off from their own convictions about what should be done to ban abortion.
Now, Virginia is Virginia, and the other 49 states are not. That said, are people looking at what's going on in Virginia as a possible dynamic we could see in 2022 elections around the country?
This election is getting an enormous amount of attention across the country, and a lot of money is flowing into the state because it's the only contested governor's race in the country this year. The other governor's race is New Jersey, where it's assumed the Democrat will win pretty handily. So this is the only close race in the country, and it's one that a lot of Democrats and Republicans are looking at as a bellwether for what's going to happen next year in the midterm elections. If the Democrats don't win this race in a state that Joe Biden won by 10 points, then they are really in trouble when it comes to next year. It means that their message is not getting through to people. It means that Joe Biden's slip in popularity may be affecting other elections across the country. If they do win, if they do pull it out, then they're going to argue that, Americans really do want the kinds of programs that Democrats in Congress and the president are pushing for. So it has it'll have a lot to say about the shape of next year's midterm elections all across the country.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Great to be with you.
That's Mark Fisher, senior editor at The Washington Post, with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. The FDA announced today that Americans can receive a COVID-19 booster vaccine that's a different brand than their initial shots. Research from the University of Maryland has found that people who get a different booster than their original shot produce more coronavirus antibodies no matter what combo they got. Ajay Sethi is here to explain more. He's an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, this new guidance just dropped from the FDA actually during the show today. It's about boosters for Moderna and Johnson & Johnson and so-called mix and match. Can you talk about what's coming out there today?
Yeah, so there's a lot of support now for mixing and matching vaccine types, so that somebody who's eligible now to be boosted can choose which vaccine they decide to get. They don't have to necessarily get the same one that they started off with.
Looking at the research, what might be the benefits? Why would there be benefits from, I don't know, if you got Pfizer originally, getting Moderna or whatever?
Well, the main thing is when you provide the immune system with sort of multiple strategies to build an immune response, you give a chance for the immune system to develop antibodies, which is through our B cells, and potentially cell-mediated immunity through our T cells. The study from University of Maryland just looked at antibodies, and in about a month or so, they're going to report whether or not T cell responses were enhanced through this mix and match strategy. But the idea is that when you give somebody multiple strategies, the immune system has sort of multiple opportunities to develop an immune response. And that activation, that greater activation of the immune system, perhaps heightens the response during the boost than if you got the exact same strategy the second time around.
Now, when it came to booster shots, up till now-ish, Pfizer was the only game in town, was the only one with the recommendation for many people 6 months after their complete round to get that new shot. Now, Moderna people could get their Moderna, Johnson & Johnson people could get their Johnson & Johnson, or mix and match. So I think, Ajay, there's going to be a lot of people out there who had one shot or another and thinking, okay, if I have this menu to choose from now, how do I decide which one I ought to seek out? What would you suggest to people as of right now anyway?
Definitely talk to your doctor and see what might be best for you. If you had side effects to one of the vaccine that you chose before, and you feel like maybe getting a different one will be better for you, that might be a reason for it. You might think that by getting another vaccine, your immune response will be better. And that's not a bad assumption, but the studies are still ongoing. The science still needs to be worked out. But I will say that if you had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine before, you will benefit by having an mRNA vaccine the next time around, either Pfizer or Moderna. Some people say Moderna because the data indicate maybe a greater response, but you know that vaccine also has a greater concentration of the mRNA that's in it. So maybe that's why it's doing that. We don't know long-term what the benefits of mix and match are, but for now, we can say for sure that it's feasible to do it. It also seems to be safe. The studies indicated that there was no red flags if you were to mix and match. And there's a convenience factor. Rather than hunt down the vaccine that you received before to get it again, you can go to your vaccine provider and potentially take whatever they have available too.
Now, in this statement, I'm looking at it from the FDA. When they talk about Moderna recipients getting a booster, they are suggesting it here for people who are 65 and older, 18 to 64, but at high risk of severe COVID-19, 18 to 64, but you got a lot of exposure because of your job, probably. That covers a lot of people, Ajay, who should be thinking about, hey, I should be seeking that booster, or talk to my doctor at least about a booster pretty soon.
Yeah, it certainly is confusing when there's so many different eligibility criteria. Certainly, if you're immunocompromised, if you're over 65, you should get boosted 6 months after the last dose that you received. For someone who's younger, maybe doesn't have underlying health conditions, but is highly exposed because they work in a place where they risk being exposed to the virus, they can also get the boost simply because we know that the antibody levels in people who receive the vaccine does wane a little bit. And you don't want it to wane to the point where being exposed to the virus puts your health at risk. And if you're more exposed, getting a booster shot is not a bad idea.
We continue to have three approved vaccines in the United States. There are some other makes and models in other countries that they have produced. Sputnik V in Russia, AstraZeneca is being used, I think, in Europe and elsewhere. Do you have your eye on other vaccines maybe coming online in the United States, ones we know about, ones still in development that might make good boosters because they complement the existing vaccines?
Yeah, so I don't have the inside information on this, but I know the Novavax vaccine, which delivers to the person getting vaccinated sort of a dose of spike protein, is believed to be maybe the booster of our future in a sense, that if you got vaccinated with an mRNA vaccine or a DNA vaccine, which is a Johnson & Johnson, following up later on with subsequent boosters sometime in the future with a protein-based vaccine might be the strategy to use. Again, the studies would have to be conducted to see the value of that, but that's the current thinking right now.
Talking to UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about booster vaccines and the idea of mixing and matching among vaccines if you get that booster. Ajay, what do we know at this point about the effectiveness of the existing vaccines unboosted when it comes to, especially to the serious cases, hospitalizations, and of course, deaths?
Yeah, the vaccines continue to show really great protection against severe illness and death. But we don't want to get to the point where that efficacy of the vaccines wane and we start to see rises in hospitalization and deaths in people who were previously vaccinated. So that's why boosting right now is part of the discussion and something that people ought to talk to their doctors about and certainly get it if they're immediately deemed eligible.
I want to think long-term here, Ajay. Of course, we have flu vaccines. People might be getting that shot right now or driving to or from it as they listen. Where we update the vaccines, we vaccinate against a few different kinds of flu each and every year. Do you see that as one possible road in the future when it comes to COVID?
It's possible. It may not necessarily be annual, but it is certainly possible, and people are thinking about that as part of our future. But again, we need to understand how long immunity lasts to know whether a boost is needed in the future on an annual basis. With influenza, we have different strains that circulate every time. So we have to come up with a new vaccine to give people to protect them against this year's strains. With the evolution of the coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, if we don't see substantial evolution warranting an annual booster, we certainly don't have a need for that. Because there's no need to vaccinate people if it's not needed.
Let's bring on a caller with a question now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've heard discussions in terms of getting boosters, how if you originally got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that it might be useful to get the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine. But I wonder if the opposite is also true. Might it be useful if one has had the messenger RNA vaccines? Might it be useful as a crossover to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for the booster?
Oh, interesting question, Tom. Thanks for that. Ajay, what do we are we hearing recommendations for that?
Well, again, recommendation will probably be that you can mix and match either way. The University of Maryland study did look at boosting with the adenovirus Johnson & Johnson vaccine in people who previously received one of the mRNA vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer. And sure enough, there's a better response by boosting with a different vaccine. To begin with, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine had a lower effectiveness or efficacy with that single shot. So it's not surprising that boosting with another shot helps. And if you previously had an mRNA vaccine where you already had two doses, pretty good immunity from the get-go, the other vaccine doesn't necessarily enhance it as much, but it does enhance it, and that's important. And it points again to this idea of mix and match, this heterologous sort of prime boost strategy that vaccine makers have been thinking about for decades, that when you give multiple strategies to an individual, vaccines that employ different strategies, you stimulate multiple arms of the immune system, which can be a good thing long term.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor and Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about mix and match COVID-19 booster shots. FDA approval for that out just this afternoon. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a relationship cut short by war.
Some people that we meet might only be in our lives momentarily, but they can have a profound effect on us that can last a lifetime. Jeffrey Saunders, a private first class in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, had that effect on Adriana Bonowitz. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Leonora Adriana Rosado Bonowitz. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois. I was 16 years old, and my mother sent me to my uncle's house in Miami during a vacation period. During this vacation, my cousin invited me to a party, and I met this young man from Jamaica. He lived there and had come also to Miami to visit his mother and sister. He was American citizen only in paper. His mother had registered him at the American Embassy when he was born, but he grew up in Jamaica and was Jamaican in his heart. This was sometime during the Vietnam War. And because he was registered as an American citizen, he was called to the service. He was, I believe, 18 or 19 years old. So we met during that vacation. Then he got his draft papers. Before he was shipped to Vietnam, he wrote to me and said, I want to come visit you in Mexico, which he did. And after he visited me, he went off to Vietnam. During a year, he wrote every time he could. I had a bunch of letters, which I kept. And in these letters, he would include photographs or mementos that he would get on a mission. He would arrive into a village and there would be empty houses, and he would pick up these little mementos, which he sent to me. And I kept all that for all these years. A year later, I received a telegram from the American Embassy telling me he had been killed. He died the death of a hero. The Viet Cong had thrown a grenade in the midst of the group where he was with his fellow soldiers, and he threw himself over the grenade to save them. And I also received a letter from his mother telling me how much he loved me, and how sad it was that what he wanted to do, which was to marry me after he returned, that would never happen. So with the grief of having lost, I wouldn't have called him my boyfriend, but a friend. I carried that all these years until 2 years ago. A friend of mine asked me about that box of letters that I've been keeping for ages. And he said, but that's a shame that you just have them in a box and nobody knows this story. Well, coincidentally, I had found out that there is in Chicago the Pritzker Military Library and Museum. So I copied all the letters and then I took everything to the Pritzker Military Library. He was a wonderful young man. And really the story of a very young life that was cut super short. He had to grow up so quickly in the face of all the danger in Vietnam for a country that he really didn't know. And he certainly would not have gone into the army if he hadn't been compelled to.
That was Adriana Bonowitz of Libertyville, Illinois. She shared her experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You'd expect to see wild turkeys in the woods, pastures, and farm fields, but more and more people are getting used to seeing them in city streets and even their own yards. The birds can be a nuisance, tearing up grass, feasting on gardens, chasing pets around, and they can tip the scales at over 20 pounds. This summer, the Milwaukee County Transit System posted a video of four turkeys blocking a bus in Wauwatosa. The driver can be heard saying it happens all the time. Thankfully, there are some simple solutions to get them to go away. You can tell us about your turkey troubles, if any, at 800-642-1234. Have you had close encounters with wild turkeys in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Throw in a picture if you've got one. Brad Cooley is a wildlife damage specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
First, some good news. Turkeys, wild turkeys, I gather, are a success story for the DNR and conservation efforts in Wisconsin. Can you share a little bit of that?
Yeah, they're a huge success story. You know, in the 1970s, turkeys were pretty much absent from the state. It was in the late 70s, the Wisconsin DNR got agreement with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and we traded some rough grouse for turkeys. So the late 70s and early 80s, approximately 300 turkeys were brought in from Missouri and released primarily in the southwest part of the state. And you know, from that point on, with some additional translocation efforts, turkeys have thrived in the state and are now present, you know, throughout the state and in Wisconsin.
Why are they getting comfy in urban parts of the state?
You know, urban areas, you know, just like deer and geese, you know, urban areas provide good habitat for turkeys. You know, there's plenty of parks and green spaces where turkeys do well. Their nesting success is good. Poult survival is good. So, yeah, it's good habitat for them. And, of course, you know, they do well in those areas.
What kind of nuisances do you run into, Brad, when it comes to wild turkeys, especially in more populated areas?
Yeah, the most common complaints that we hear about are certainly scratching up mulch beds and flower beds, you know, perching on vehicles or above vehicles and houses and you know, fecal matter on driveways and sidewalks. You know, in the springtime when turkeys are more territorial and aggressive, you know, they'll peck at windows when they see the reflection in the window or even peck on vehicles. And, you know, that causes property damage that way. In some cases, turkeys will get aggressive. You know, a few years ago in Madison, you know, a turkey flew right into a male Jeep and scratched the driver there. We've had reports of turkeys chasing kids on their way to school. So, yeah, you know, for the most part, the turkeys, you know, behave, but they certainly can cause some problems and create some traffic issues as well.
Well, let's look at some solutions, Brad. First of all, if we say, okay, we don't want turkeys in this area, this yard or whatever, what kind of things can we do to make it a little less turkey friendly?
Yeah, the big thing is not to feed them. You know, any type of food attractant, you know, that's going to keep a turkey there is kind of a, you know, invitation for problems. You know, those turkeys will persist in that area and obviously to get to that food source. So, you know, don't feed is a primary one. If you have turkey in your area and you don't want them, you know, certainly harassment and hazing. You can legally harass and haze turkeys as long as you're not physically harming them, you know, make them feel unwanted or you know, not welcome in your area. So those are some common, you know, easy things that homeowners can do if they do have turkeys in their neighborhood and they're not welcome. You know, if things escalate, if those non-lethal methods, you know, aren't successful, you know, there are options for municipalities. You know, the DNR will permit trapping and removal of those turkeys or trapping and euthanizing those turkeys if problems persist and get to a point where the municipality feels additional control efforts are needed.
And for feeding them, I understand something people might not think about. If I have a bird feeder up and I'm feeding those flying birds, a lot of that ends up on the ground. Is that a common attractant to turkeys, that bird feeder residue?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, intentionally or even unintentionally feeding. So, yeah, that residue, you know, that seed that might spill out over the bird feeder, you know, when the birds are there, you know, that's going to attract those turkeys and they're going to pick and take advantage of that. So, yeah, if you have, you know, if that's occurring, you know, some type of a containment device or catch device, you know, that will prevent those seeds from hitting the ground will be helpful in reducing problems with turkeys.
Now, in that situation where I want to haze and harass a turkey, what are some of the best ways to do that with, you know, common household materials or things I might be carrying around with me?
Yeah, being pots and pans, you know, you can throw sticks at them. You know, some people will shoot them with squirt guns, you know, things like that. Just, you know, kind of common things that are ready accessible and available, you know, to harass and make those turkeys feel unwelcome in your yard or, you know, in your neighborhood.
How common are, you mentioned a turkey flying into a mail truck. How common is it, though, that turkeys actually physically attack humans? It seems pretty rare.
Yeah, it's pretty rare. You know, those are kind of the severe cases. You know, we don't hear about those all the time. But, yeah, certainly they can get aggressive, you know, and spur and cause problems that way. You know, they can lead to, you know, kind of secondary concerns or injuries as well. You know, people running away and being fearful of the turkeys, you know, tripping and falling and things like that. So it's not necessarily that they're going to cause an injury themselves, but, you know, they could secondarily, you know, cause an injury by running and tripping and falling away. You know, they can be pretty intimidating. You know, like I said, we've had some complaints about turkeys near schoolyards and chasing kids and stuff. And, you know, if you're a smaller kid, I'm sure a 20, 25, 30 pound turkey is probably pretty intimidating, especially if it's a tom, you know, that's all fanned out in the springtime. So, you know, yeah, they can be pretty intimidating with their size, you know, but typically those standard harassment and non-lethal abatement techniques work pretty well.
Brad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Brad Cooley is a wildlife damage specialist for the state DNR. We talked to him about wild turkeys, especially in urban areas, what we can do to avoid conflict. You could share your turkey stories or photos on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Christine in rural Elroy. She says they're everywhere, often in big groups. Often think I'm going to hit one with the car, but haven't. And Kurt says a few years ago, a group of wild turkeys sauntered across her front yard on Thanksgiving. Must have been in mourning. Share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, from mask mandates to issues of race, school boards are at the center of controversy here in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll look at protests and recalls and more here in the state, lots of them in the state, and you can share your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection is ramping up pressure on former President Donald Trump and his advisors. We'll get the latest in our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network.